Welcome to the Biomedical Frontiers Podcast, where we explore pivotal research projects and disruptive innovations aimed at translating scientific advancements into tangible healthcare solutions. I'm your host, Dasha Tischler.
The thing that captivated me about the larynx, the voice box, and which is the center of what I do in otolaryngology, or ear, nose, and throat, was the relationship to physics. And so it is a very mechanical structure. There's vocal cords that have to come together. They have to be the right pliability, and they have to have the right vibratory properties in order to sustain the vibration and produce voice.
The collaboration we have with Jim, we're looking at cleft palate. The current therapies to treat cleft palate could be rightly described as brutal in order to get to a solution.
Can you describe a little bit of what the current standard of care for that looks like and why it's so challenging?
It can be really dramatic health problem in addition to a communication problem. And so what's done now for kids that have a poorly functioning palate or cleft palate is that there's surgeries to lengthen the palate or tighten up the palate or close the palate off partially and leave ports on the sides just to be able to breathe through your nose. There's a decent failure rate in that surgery. And if we augment the posterior wall with an injectable substance, minimally invasive, could be performed in clinic, doesn't require invasive surgery, that would solve those issues.
I would say one of the biggest lessons that I've learned is really trying to be able to determine what are the features of a material that are needed and how does that balance with the regulatory process.
Welcome to another episode of Biomedical Frontiers, Stories with Innovators in Healthcare. Today we have two wonderful guests, Dr. Don Griffin and Dr. James Daniero. Dr. James Daniero is the Associate Professor of Otolaryngology at University of Virginia Medical School, where he helped found the Voice and Swallowing Clinic, as well as the Laryngology Division. He's also the co-founder of a new company here in Charlottesville, Reflux Raft, which provides acid reflux supplemental treatments to patients. Here in Charlottesville, he's also on the Health Advisory Board for CAB Angels, and he also is a founding member of the North American Airway Collaborative. Dr. Don Griffin is the Associate Professor of Biomedical Engineering at University of Virginia, where he's also the director of the Graduate Engineering Program. His laboratory at University of Virginia investigates both the fundamental science of biomaterials as well as develops new translational approaches to treating wounds and regenerating tissues using biomaterials. His company, Tempo Therapeutics, utilizes proprietary microporous annealed particle gels to help with tissue scaffolding, tissue regeneration, and wound healing. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
It's such a pleasure. Well, before we dive into your collaborative projects, I just want to start a little bit with your backgrounds. Dr. Daniero, before you got into medicine, you were actually in biotech and health policy. How has your work in health policy influenced your clinical pathway and what you're able to do for patients?
Yeah, so before I even knew I wanted to be a physician, I was interested in healthcare and I was interested in science. And this was coming out of undergrad. I went to Georgetown for graduate school in biotechnology, and I realized that maybe my future didn't lie in the laboratory as a full-time job. I wasn't really sure exactly what I wanted to do next. So I worked in healthcare policy. I was in DC already, and I was exposed to some incredible mentorship through an organization, the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies, and working with some of the top academic researchers, physician scientists in the country there at as a low-level research associate, I was exposed to a different idea of what it meant to be a physician. And that's what captured me and had me pursue a career in medicine. And particularly, I knew going into medical school, I wanted to be a physician scientist. I knew I wanted to combine my love of science with the direct patient care and exercise sort of both sides of my brain in that way.
What's unique about being in the role where you get to be a clinician, but also you get to conduct research within an academic setting?
Yeah, I mean, that is the most incredible thing about being a physician scientist is the ability to be on the front lines of healthcare, to see problems occur in real time. We see you know, my patients tell me what the problems are because they come in and they have a problem and they're asking for help. And so when I hear the same problem over and over and over again, and I keep telling them that we don't have a great solution for that, eventually my apology is not worth anything anymore. It's, I have to do something about it. And so that's when I start looking for solutions and people that can help me create those solutions.
So one of the things that's really interesting about the discipline otolaryngology, and specifically you do neck and head surgery, is just how intricate everything is in the body and that part of the body. Can you talk a little bit about the specialization for voice specifically? And what are the challenges that most people don't realize with treating conditions and particularly conducting surgery in that part of the body?
Yeah, the thing that captivated me about the larynx, the voice box, and which is the center of what I do in otolaryngology, or ear, nose, and throat, was the relationship to physics. And so it is a very mechanical structure. There's vocal cords that have to come together. They have to be the right pliability, and they have to have the right vibratory properties in order to sustain vibration and produce voice. Then the tongue and the throat articulate in very fine maneuvers to be able to make speech out of that sound. And so it's really like if I had to make it a basic description of the machine of the voice, it is power that's driven from the lungs. And then there's a resonating source that's your vocal cords and your larynx. And then there is the filter afterwards that is determining what frequencies are amplified and not amplified that turn it into speech that happens in the throat with the muscles of articulation, such as the tongue and the palate.
So what I hear you saying is it's like the most difficult musical instrument that's ever been invented. And in order to fix any problems with it, you're tuning like a huge amount of different factors that are all biological and in their nature. Is that?
Yes, that is a great description. And often what I talk about with patients is like, you were born with a certain instrument and there's parts of it that are innate to your makeup, your anatomy, but there's also parts of it that then we can begin to fine tune in order to restore function. And so that instrument is like tuning a guitar, is something that is very delicate and has to be well taken care of.
So I saw that the two of you have received a $3 million grant in order to work on restoring vocal cords using Dr. Griffin's MAPS technology. How did you identify that Dr. Griffin's work would have applications in the clinic for the voice of restoration work?
Yeah, this is where I had an issue with patients over and over asking for a solution. We did not have any long-term, minimally invasive option to restore function to people with damaged vocal cords. And I was looking at the literature for what was out there. There was a lot of substandard use of biomaterials that did not have the properties that really the voice required. They were sort of borrowed from cosmetics. And then I went and I started looking for people that could help solve this in our amazing biomedical engineering department at UVA. And Shane Pierce-Kotler connected me with Don, and the rest is history. We met at Bodo's. You know, it was a classic place to meet to discuss science. So we met at Bodo's and I presented some of the papers and I said, can you help solve this problem? And there was not a hesitation. If I remember it correctly, Don was like, absolutely.
Overconfidence in its best form.
Yeah, well, it's worked. So that's been the exciting part of the trip.
Dr. Griffin, can you tell us, first of all, what is a microporous annealed particle gel?
Sure. MAP, or microporous annealed particle gel, is composed of a slurry or a solution of hydrogel particles. Those hydrogel particles are pre-manufactured, which is nice because then whatever volume you put into a person stays that volume, as opposed to typical gels that you put in, they'll swell. The other thing that is sort of a central hallmark of it is that because they are particles that are preformed, they're spheres. Spheres don't pack perfectly. And so when you inject that into a space, you can imagine it like a ball pit where you have this air in between. Well, it's not air in the case of the body, it's water, and cells can grow into it. And so that's really what the MAP scaffold is. It's a hydrogel scaffold on a large scale, but it's made up of these little individual particle building blocks.
When you were first developing this technology, did you have any idea about applications in voice?
No. None whatsoever.
So what was your reaction? You're at Botos. Can we reenact the scene?
I am extremely lucky to have met Jim within about 4 months of arriving here at UVA was my initial reaction. I think the clinical problems that Jim was describing felt well within the abilities of the chemistries we'd worked with before. And so it did require us to tune the material to the properties he was going for, longevity being a key component. But that getting hydrogels to stick around a long time has never really been the problem. So it's usually getting them to come and go as the body needs that's been an issue. So I knew the chemistry was there. It was just packaging it into the MAP scaffold platform.
So when for this $3 million grant that you guys are working on right now, obviously the goal is to develop something that is going to be long-term feasible for multiple surgeons across all the countries of the world to be able to use. What's the process between you guys connecting Botos and where you are now and where you're going to in the future with this technology?
Yeah, from my standpoint, I keep thinking of what are the barriers that are going to keep us from getting this into patients, because I continue to face the same patients that originally I promised I'm going to start working on this in the lab. And they come back and are wondering what the progress is and when can they get their hands on it, or when can I get my hands on it to use it for them. And so that's a fascinating area of translational medicine that is fraught with a lot of pitfalls. So obviously we need to prove the concept. We've done that. We've had a seminal publication in Nature Regenerative Medicine based on our work, sort of year-long animal study. But then we have to do studies that are going to be satisfying regulatory requirements beyond the proof of concept. And so moving into a GMP or GMP-like study where we have the actual manufactured material that we used in patients. So we have to do that study. We've had some meetings with the FDA. Likely have to show that a year-long animal study in dogs is what's required. It's what's been in the precedent for doing a de novo 510K process. So that, you know, it has a few years more of work before getting it there to patients. Obviously, we need a strong partner in the process as well from a manufacturing standpoint. And so there is a company that Don knows well that is likely going to play that role.
Way to lay that up. Yes, being able to work, having already scaled up the process of being able to make MAP for a different application with Tempo Therapeutics, the company that I co-founded, gave us a very easy on-ramp, or at least a on-ramp that we can see to be able to manufacture this at scale. So contracting, at least at the very beginning for the R&D aspects with Tempo, and then seeing that as a long-term manufacturing option is also a key component of the application we put into the NIH to get the $3 million grant you mentioned.
Perfect. Well, so let's talk a little bit about then the background and the Tempo Therapeutics piece of it. So first of all, Dr. Griffin, how did you get into biomaterials in the first place, and this particular technology that you've developed, which is the MAPS?
So I first started working with hydrogels in fall of 2006 when I started my PhD for completely different applications. I still distinctly remember my PhD advisor, Andrea Casco, showing me how to make my first hydrogel. That was a very important moment in my life because it was just magic in a way to see that. And I kind of was hooked at that point. Now, for my PhD, I was doing everything for drug delivery, and it was more very conceptually oriented, light-activated drug delivery. It was still very early stage applications. However, I was doing my postdoc with Professor Tatiana Skura, who's now at Duke University, where I first looked into this idea of regenerative medicine and how hydrogels could fit into that space. It was, I mean, I saw how others had looked in that space and wanted to join the party. And so being able to see the limitations of current technologies, what technologies had kind of pushed the boundaries of being able to integrate with the body, because that's always been sort of the limitation in the field, is you can build something that looks, smells, tastes like the soft tissue of the body. However, once it gets in there, the body has a trouble integrating with it. And so there was wonderful work that was done by Professor Buddy Ratner at the University of Washington that really laid the groundwork for that a porous hydrogel is able to integrate with the body irrespective of its ability to fall apart within the body. So, yeah, go ahead.
So you're saying the state of the art previously for tissue regenerative hydrogels has been, is the hydrogel was not porous. So what does that mean? And what was the result of that in the body? And then how is the microporous different?
So the natural response of the body for any foreign material is called the foreign body response, where the body recognizes it as not being self and then encapsulates it within a fibrotic encapsulation, effectively creating a wall. And this is a evolutionarily established process to save the body from things getting inside. Think of a large splinter that might be full of bacteria. With biomaterials, that's always been the hurdle, is sort of saying, hey, don't treat me like a splinter. Treat me like something that's actually going to help you. And so in other areas like bone, we've seen that the introduction of porosity has great effects on the body's ability to accept materials. There's a lot of amazing work that has been done, I mentioned with porosity and amongst others, that would be considered cutting edge during this period. But the limitation still was, in order to gain porosity, you had to give something up. But in return, porosity really on a cell scale allows the body to grow into a material and helps to diminish that foreign body response. And that's kind of the setting that I walked into when I started working on it.
You now have a company, Tempo Therapeutics, which is, I saw on your website, there are multiple applications for this that you're exploring. First of all, where did you guys get started?
So the first project, so pre-company that we were telling this, was for dermal or skin wound healing. And it was a model that existed in the lab that I was within. And so it was a natural first testing ground. It's also one that you can observe relatively easily. And so that first proof of concept was in skin. We showed that we could accelerate the rate with which the skin would close within a wound, which helps to prevent infection. It would also produce a lower fibrotic response, so avoiding scar. So that was we saw those positive results. And so that was our test product. That was our first go. The 101 product, if you will, was for dermal wound healing.
And then as you're thinking about different application that this is, what are you considering in order to figure out where that best technology meets need is?
Sure. There's really two areas that the company views and I view as being areas of need within the biomaterial space. One is the ability to push regeneration versus healing. And so that's chronic wounds. That's what our first area that we looked into were chronic wounds, diabetic wounds, vascular ulcers. That's sort of one pot, if you will, of areas that can fit. Anything where the healing process results in a scar and not functional tissue, there's an opportunity to scaffold something that's not scar. And MAP, through its ability to integrate with the body and sort of avoid scar formation, allows you to maybe have real muscle instead of a scar for skeletal muscle. It avoids a scar formation on the skin. It allows you to have normal skin with hair follicles and sweat and that sort of thing. The other bin that we see as being a value is the ability to create new tissue from in an area that would not have any response. So this is parts of the body that are stable, but they're not really getting the physiological effect that you want. And this is where the project with Dr. Daniero fits in, where if nothing is done to the vocal cords, they will stay there and they will not improve. And so we need some sort of intervention that will improve it. And so that's where a lot of the current interventions were. We're trying to add bulk. But the bulk that you're adding was foreign, not something that would be sort of the ideal, which is return to normal physiological tissue. And so that's the other bin for MAP, is the ability to put in there a scaffold to build tissue that would not have existed otherwise.
I see. And what are some of the particular challenges that you have encountered as you've been working in the airway and in the vocal cords? They may be different from some of the other applications.
I think, you know, one of the unique things, and so going back to that conversation at Bodo's when we first met, was, you know, I think I really challenged Dr. Griffin to solve a complex problem, mainly because we weren't just trying to rebuild tissue. We were trying to rebuild tissue that had certain biomechanical properties in a dynamic environment. The vocal cords have to move. They vibrate 100 to 200 times per second to make speech. And so this is tissue that isn't just sitting there lying dormant, but this is it has a function. And it's also in a space that is difficult to access because it's down and deep in the throat and the vocal cords. And not only that, it is a caustic environment. There's bacteria and enzymes and saliva and all kinds of food particulates that are in the region. And to introduce a biomaterial through that region and into the vocal cord and get it to not have infection, rejection, and resorption is like near impossible task. And so that's where I think Don was like, I think we should do this. This is really hard to do, but he's the right guy.
You make me sound really good.
Well, you are really good.
Is from your perspective, looking at all the various applications of the MAP gels, what is the most sort of promising? This seems like one of the most challenging. Is there an area that's also very promising, but maybe farther out, something exploratory that you're thinking about right now?
Let's see. Exploratory. That's a good question. I think that there is work that we're focused on within the collaboration we have with Jim. We're looking at cleft palate. I think that that would be obviously a well-known area that needs help. The current therapies to treat cleft palate are could be rightly described as brutal in order to get to a solution. And so because it is a brutal reconstruction process. And so if we can assist that in some ways, that would be an amazing, amazing value added to patients.
Can you describe a little bit of what the current standard of care for that looks like and why it's so challenging?
Yeah. So mainly what we're targeting is velopharyngeal insufficiency, or people will term it VPI. And that's excessive nasal escape during speech. So you might have somebody who has a very hypernasal voice, but in severe cases, it's difficult to even understand somebody that's speaking with the increased nasal airflow because they can't close their palate off to have the speech just come out through their mouth. And so we have that problem on top of a swallowing problem. And in children, this can be really severe because as you go to swallow, if the palate can't close off the oral cavity from the nasal cavity, you have nasal regurgitation. And so you have problems where food is going up and down as they're swallowing, and liquids up and down as they're swallowing, which can lead to issues of aspiration and choking. And so it can be really dramatic health problem in addition to a communication problem. And so what's done now for kids that have a poorly functioning palate or cleft palate is that there's surgeries to lengthen the palate or tighten up the palate or close the palate off partially and leave ports on the sides just to be able to breathe through your nose. But there's a decent failure rate in that surgery where, number one, it may not be effective, and number two, it can cause a lot of nasal obstruction if it's done incorrectly. And so, and wound healing is sometimes unpredictable, and it may not necessarily be the surgeon's fault. It's just the way that, you know, the palate, which has to be the soft dynamic structure, might heal with scar and not function properly. So as an alternative to that solution, there have been surgeons will intervene by injecting the posterior pharyngeal wall. So this is the wall that sits behind the palate, where the palate would move up against it to augment that side so the palate doesn't have to do all the work. And if we augment the posterior wall with an injectable substance, minimally invasive, could be performed in clinic, doesn't require invasive surgery, that would solve those issues. The problem is the materials that we have, similar to the vocal cord, are temporary in duration, and they're borrowed from the cosmetic surgery world where they were designed to be injected into the face. Very different purpose and very different function, and therefore they don't work well in this space for restoring speech and swallow function. And so the beauty of the MAP gel invention is that it has the porosity to allow for tissue ingrowth. And what we showed in our Nature Regenerative Materials paper, Nature Regenerative Medicine paper, is that we do actually grow tissue in where the implant was injected, even after the implant is resorbed. And so it has a volumetric one-to-one expansion, which has not been shown with any material, let alone a material that's soft and durable.
So
just, and if I might jump in, one added value to that, and particularly for cleft palate, is the mention that children are involved. And so having a material that can be replaced by soft tissue allows for that healed tissue to grow with the person after they've healed, as opposed to our vocal cord work, which is more focused on adults, where you're kind of regenerating, and the idea is that they don't have to have another application. But with children, you hopefully can do a fix that once it's fixed, they can mature normally.
So the idea, just to reiterate that, first of all, where you put in the gel, the tissue grows to occupy that same space, not any further, not any less, basically grows into that space, and then that gel is absorbed as it's growing. And
that's
then correct. The hope is also for children, once it's grown, as their bodies grow, now that new part of their body that's kind of, so that's what the scaffold is, mm-hmm. basically. It's scaffolding where the cells grow. That's fantastic. That is really groundbreaking. What sort of the edges of the tissue engineering world right now? Like, where are people pushing to develop? What are some of the challenges that exist out there, whether you're working on them or you're just observing them on the sidelines as an expert in the field?
I think the biggest challenge is it's still function. So regeneration of tissue so that you get as close to physiological function as possible. So it's one thing to avoid scar. It's another to ultimately return to baseline. And so I think that's the final frontier for regenerative medicine, is to truly regenerate all the way back to the point where you wouldn't be able to tell that an intervention ever happened.
So what about some of this work that you've also been doing with airway regeneration after intubation? I know this issue got a lot of airtime during kind of the peak of COVID, because we were seeing a lot more people getting intubated and a lot more people were experiencing. Can you talk a little bit about how that project got started and where that fits within all the collaborations you two have going on together?
Yeah, you know, this, obviously we'd started with our voice application, and then after Don and I were working together for some time, I was in the middle of COVID and we were sort of strapped resources in the hospital, and we were talking about sharing ventilators and not having enough ventilators for patients. And, you know, we were in the throes of COVID and trying to figure out ways to prevent and or treat COVID. But what I was seeing was the evolution of my practice. And so this is, again, where patients are informing me of the problems that need to be solved. And then I just have to find ways of solving them. So I went back to Don and I said, we have this problem where people have been intubated and they sit on the ventilator for a long period of time and they develop pressure ulcers, or pressure necrosis. And Don has shared how they've been looking at ways of using MAP gel for vascular ulcers and diabetic ulcers. And I said, well, we have a new problem now because of all these patients that are intubated. We have airway ulcers. And so we then went in through the IV Biomedical Foundation, applied for a grant for a specific COVID request, and we're funded through them to do a study of intubation wound healing, and initially started out with a rabbit airway model, which mimics an infant child that would have an airway injury up to about a month as a direct correlate in the anatomy, and then had success in that initial application. Don took the expertise of developing the material, so I'll let him explain how that was a unique challenge as well.
Yeah, so one of the unique challenges of that airway treatment was actually bleeding. That's one thing that we saw early on with our models, was that you have to stem the bleeding within these animals in order to start the healing process. And getting, as opposed to other wounds where maybe the wound healing process and the bleeding naturally arrests more quickly, we were noticing that this was actually a significant problem. So we looked within literature of the materials and determined that a compound known as chitosan. It's been known for a very long time to stimulate blood clotting. And so we said, okay, we have a problem. There's a material solution. Let's just figure out how we then incorporate that chitosan into MAP. So MAP as a platform technology allows us to add on new chemistries relatively easily. And so we modified our building blocks, those particle building blocks, to present the chitosan within the wound. And we had the intended effect of arresting that bleeding and allowing us to avoid fibrosis.
Yeah. And I would say even more of a challenge. So we talked about the biomechanical properties of voice. Now we're talking, instead of injecting into the vocal cord, we're talking about using a biomaterial on the surface of a dynamic structure that is bathed in bacteria and enzymes and coughing, sneezing, all of the mechanical trauma that a implant would have to sustain directly. And so this was like a moonshot type of approach where there's, you know, very low likelihood that we're going to be successful at keeping an implant in this really caustic environment. And it did take us several rounds of figuring out how we were going to solve that problem. But Don and the work that was done in his lab were able to find a solution that actually allowed for the tissue, the material to bond to the tissue after we stemmed the issue of surface bleeding not allowing for adherence, then incorporated more chemistry so that it really bound tightly and was not dislodged and allowed for that healing process.
How does the work that you're doing translationally, seeing the impact and potentially the translation into human subjects, how is that influencing kind of the more fundamental science, the basic research part of your lab's work?
It brings into question the balance of how much of the work is going to be focused on basic science versus how much is translational. So a lot of what we'll do is see if we run up against a problem, is there a technology that's already been developed, already invented, but can be incorporated into the format, the platform technology, the map platform technology, to take advantage of it in a new way. And so I'd say that is probably the primary way in which trying to get things to the clinic and focused on clinical solutions as quickly as possible has influenced my lab as a biomaterials lab. I was trained by polymer chemists. Synthetic chemistry is in my blood at this point, but fighting that urge to want to make the new solution and seeing, okay, what's already out there that we can more quickly get into this material and see whether or not it has the effect we want.
Are you also then collaborating outside of the University of Virginia with some of these other labs that are working on solutions that end up becoming part of your...
Yes. We do work with labs at Virginia Tech, at University of Georgia, now recently at the FDA with some of the work that we do. I still have my collaborators back at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, where I started, that we continue to have those collaborations as well. So my lab is trying to stay in touch with multiple different experts and application areas.
So I want to kind of turn our conversation a little bit towards the entrepreneurial pursuits that both of you have, because you have this additional exposure to then not just developing a technology and testing it, but then trying to bring it into the world so that it can be widespread. And that has a whole different set of challenges that accompany it. So Dr. Griffin, starting with you and Tempo Therapeutics, what are you learning from your entrepreneurial pursuit with Tempo Therapeutics that's also translating into your practice as a scientist, as a researcher?
I would say one of the biggest lessons that I've learned is really trying to be able to determine what are the features of a material that are needed and how does that balance with the regulatory process. So you kind of have to say what the ideal, there's the academic ideal of the material to develop, and then there is what will pass muster with the regulatory agencies, where they are either cautious because of past lessons, or you'd have to spend a significant amount of time basically building a body of work to support that whatever new feature you'd be designing into the material, new surface chemistries, new ligands for activating some sort of bioactivity, are those needed? Or can you achieve 90% of the effect in something that's simple and that is more easily passed through the regulatory pathway? And then those add-ons that can maybe make it even better can be follow-on. I think that's a big
simplification
lesson.
Of get to the bare minimum that will both pass the regulatory and achieve the clinical goals. It's actually the opposite of what I would have imagined, but it makes a lot of sense. And how about for yourself, Dr. Deniero?
Speaking about the biomaterial or
about
from
the
entrepreneurial experience?
Pursuits.
So, you know, my interest in the entrepreneurial aspects of medicine and healthcare really came out of this collaboration initially, because I knew that in order to get this into patients, we're going to have to run the gauntlet through the Food and Drug Administration, other regulatory agencies, because if we're injecting it in a closed space inside the body, it would be a higher burden. And this is a novel material. And so I knew that this would be a difficult commercialization process. And so I then tried to learn as, and the other thing that I realized, and you talk about lessons learned, is that if I don't do that, no one's going to do it for me. Particularly our niche field of otolaryngology, the ENT field, is not a massive market. And so I don't lead the charge of innovation for our patients. There's not going to be that many people are going to be lining up behind me to kind of carry the torch. And so I quickly realized that we were going to have to figure out how to do this on our own, or I was going to have to get some expertise that I didn't already have through medical training or from any of my basic science training. It certainly did not lead a path forward. And so I found out about an organization, Cav Angels, that was investing in startup companies that were coming mainly out of UVA technology, and then started reviewing and doing diligence, the diligence memos and due diligence process for companies that they were investing in, and got an inside look at what startup companies look like and how they function, how they succeed, and how they fail. And I knew in startup world, you have to, you know, fail early, fail quickly, learn what doesn't work, and keep moving forward. And in this case, I didn't have to actually do the failing myself, where I could watch other people fail and learn from multiple other companies before we ended up having to move our technology forward in partnership with Tempo or start a new company or with another company that would acquire the licensing through both entities, UVA and Tempo. And so knowing that and getting that experience, I then came across my second idea that patients were asking me about, which was solving this issue with reflux problems. And through connections that I encountered in the business world in Charlottesville, then founded or co-founded the company Reflux Raft, which we make an all-natural supplement to help treat reflux. And it's not actually, you know, we're not an FDA-regulated product, so it's a supplement that helps relieve the symptoms of reflux. I have to be careful about how I say that, not necessarily treat disease. But we do find that as a helpful solution, instead of treating the acid part of acid reflux, it actually blocks the reflux from happening in the first place. So it keeps acid where it belongs in the stomach, not necessarily trying to suppress the acid and change body chemistry.
So you mentioned learning from failure from other people. I totally, by the way, totally support that view. I think reading, getting involved in things where you're reviewing, doing due diligence, if you want to be an entrepreneur, learn to learn from other people's mistakes as much as possible.
Absolutely.
Because you can't make all the mistakes yourself. So if you can learn from others, then you might make a few yourself. But then going out and starting a company, what are some of the things that have accelerated your learning?
So I think, you know, in medicine, where there's a lot of teamwork and a lot of training, that going through residency, and it's really trying to provide care that's really complex. There's a lot of leadership training in that setting. What I don't have the training in is how to develop a culture of a business and how to work and resolve differing opinions. In the healthcare world, there's a hierarchy, and there is a natural process that these problems get solved. You just keep asking one level higher, and generally you get an answer, whether it's right or wrong. At least it's a decision. In the business world, it doesn't work that way. And so I had to reframe a lot of how to interact and how to solve complex problems where there's a lot of strong opinion, and there's a different ecosystem to navigate. And so that, I think, is, you know, the biggest take-home point from building a business.
Has that affected also your clinical practice?
I think as far as like the lesson learned feedback to the clinic, absolutely. I mean, so there's definitely a different framework that I have in how we solve problems and how we run our center and even how we want to optimize an efficiency of the clinic and manage personnel. All that is really a different perspective I have now from these other activities that I certainly didn't have as a physician. And I think we're trained to do mostly one thing, you know, a couple different things when we're surgeons as well, but surgeons and treat patients. But, you know, the leadership skills are not very well trained, I think, in our medical training. They're getting better at it. They're changing the curriculums, but I think we're still way behind where they are in the business world.
Dr. Griffin, how about for yourself, your work with Tempo Therapeutics, working with the people aspect of things? How has that changed generally your research, your science?
I would say that it gives more motivation. So I think that being able to see an idea, which happened over the holidays in 2013 for me, be manifested into a technology, which is MAP, and then seeing that then translate to the point where it is on the verge of treating patients it's motivating to see that development, the evolution, and to know that it can make it, I think, is really the key. Because I think that you can almost get jaded when you're in the ivory tower of that it's for the ideas. And so actually seeing them come to fruition has definitely been a motivator for me and for my team.
Well, speaking of the motivation and the vision forward, where do you see maybe the next 10 years of your research creating impact? Where are you heading for the next 10 years of your research?
It goes back to that goal that we talked about earlier, that idea of moving the needle as close to regeneration as possible. I think that MAP, along with, I would say it's fair, it feels like it has opened a bit of a door that maybe that wasn't as relevant there before, where maybe that is a possibility of being able to heal tissue that previously would never have been anything but scar back to something that resembles nothing like scar. And damage never happened. Being able to build a tissue within the body that's not just a foreign body encapsulation, that actually is a soft tissue that's functioning and can help the person. I think, I don't think I'll get there in 10 years, but I think I'll get closer.
Are you going to be going, say, more deep, like continuing focusing in on the airway voice, or are you also thinking up broadly and applying this in unique and maybe things you haven't tested out yet in terms of collaborations?
There's always new clinical problems, or I guess they're old clinical problems, but they're new to me. And I think Jim will keep them coming.
Yeah, there's no end to the problems that I'm going to continue to bring down because he's done so well solving them so far.
And how about for yourself? Where do you see laryngology, head and neck surgery in particular, where do you see like the next 10 years? What might be changed and transformed about what treatments are available, not just from the work you do, but from the work you see done around you as well?
Yeah, I think one of the frontiers that we have not figured out, I think in the body in general, but you know, the central nervous system, the peripheral nervous system, that is a frontier that will, you know, see some dramatic advances and innovations in the, you know, the next 10, 20 years as we learn more about how nerves regenerate and how we can steer nerves to regenerate in ways that we have really just relied on the body to just sort of figure out so far. And we have fairly rudimentary ways of trying to guide that process. And we're just reliant on the nerves to, which fortunately do a pretty good job. It's remarkable how they're able to heal. But we certainly can do better with guiding them from a biomedical engineering standpoint.
Are you seeing any greater appetite, better methods for this type of collaboration that you have where more clinicians and scientists are working together? Is this becoming a bigger thing in the world generally?
I mean, I would hope it is something that is continuing to be more and more common. And I think it probably is based on programs like the Coulter Foundation. I mean, that's how we got started. You know, our collaboration was initially funded as a Coulter application. We took it from there and had several rounds of Coulter funding. We had Ivy Biomedical Foundation funding. They both require a PhD biomedical engineer and a doctor, a medical doctor to apply. for those grants. And then that's led us to NIH funding now. So I think programs like that being more successful will lead us in this way. And then also, I think, you know, the days of the old, you know, physician scientist or, you know, the academic physician that does research and this is what I'm doing now. So I'm saying, you know, I'm a dinosaur, but I do think that there is less and less of clinicians' availability to actually perform the work of the research. And that collaboration is really key to advancing at least the medical science.
I think institutes like UVA that put a clear emphasis on clinician-scientist interactions, that team science, having the clinician in there to drive home translation, to drive home relevancy, is not unique to UVA, but is certainly in the backbone of UVA. And so having more and more of that developing at other institutes would certainly be nice to see. I think that the very existence of funding opportunities like the Coulter Foundation provides is evidence that things are moving that way, or at least some people want to move it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we are seeing, you know, the success, you know, the adoption of some of our early work into more, you know, the governmental grants and into the larger grant cycles has direct relationship to the clinical impact merging with the state-of-the-art science. And that is forced in that way through the early funding mechanisms like Coulter. And so it just becomes a higher yield situation.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Daniero, Dr. Griffin, thank you so much for your time and thank you for joining me on the Biomedical Frontiers podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Biomedical Frontiers, stories with innovators in healthcare. My name is David Chen, and I am the Managing Director of the Wallace H. Coulter Center for Translational Research at the University of Virginia. Our mission is to help bring promising new biomedical research and technology into the hands of the provider and the patient. If you found this episode valuable, please let us know by subscribing, following, or sharing. You can learn more about our promising translational research projects on our website. See links in the show notes.